From the 89.1 WBOI studios in Fort Wayne, Indiana, welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and thank you for joining me. Our show this week comes from the Values, Ideas, and the Arts series at Manchester University. We'll hear from Fort Wayne City Councilman Glenn Hines, 1973 Manchester graduate, who spoke about his experiences as a black student in the 1960s and 70s. Rightful Objectives, 50 years of black student organizing at Manchester. Please enjoy the show.
Good evening, and welcome everyone to the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Remembrance and Rededication Ceremony. I am Dr. Megan Polony, and I am the Director of Student Diversity and Inclusion here at Manchester. Today, I am humbled and honored to be able to deliver the welcome and opening address to you all as I recognize the great importance of this event. Manchester University, with its brethren roots, has always been in the forefront for events surrounding peace studies and social justice activities. This ability has been demonstrated by the university inviting the Honorable Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to deliver a speech in 1968, as well as the esteemed Shirley Chisholm in 1978. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at Manchester in 1968 was entitled "The Future of Integration," because, as we know, the United States at this time was not very united. The civil rights era marks in our history a time of great violence and divide. But out of that tumultuous era also birthed a mighty message of hope, good triumphing over evil, and light driving out darkness. In Dr. King's words, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." And so tonight we remember, we celebrate, but we also rededicate ourselves to that legacy. As Dr. King stated, we must shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. We must shift from a self and material orientation to a brother and love orientation. Dr. King was known for his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. This speech was so inspirational and moving because of its message, but it was also so relatable to many of us because we can all agree that it is crucial to have dreams. Dreams are what gives us hope for another day. But it is also important to remember that dreams are not realized when we are sleeping. Dreams are actualized when we wake up, rise up, and at times even act up. Then is when you live out your dreams. That is why, my friends, I am so honored to be able to be in the presence of Councilman Hines tonight. It is because of his dream and the dream of so many other students of color and their actions that we can walk the halls today with a sense of belonging and ownership in our education. President McFadden, unfortunately, could not be here tonight due to a family matter, but he shares these words about Councilman Hines. "Glenn Hines has a passion for social justice. It is rooted in his childhood during the 1960s and the civil rights movement. It is also rooted in his time as a student at Manchester, where Glenn's passion was fed by this university's historic commitment to social justice and making the world a better place through service. In the late 1960s, Glenn was part of an influx of African-American students at Manchester, and he became a leader on campus. He was in creation and naming of Afro Club, which stood for Afro-Americans Forming Rightful Objectives. Afro Club is the precursor to today's Jean Charles Young Intercultural Center. Glynn graduated from Manchester in 1973 with a double major in history and speech and drama, and completed graduate schools at Temple University. Since 1999, he has served on the Fort Wayne City Council. Through his council work and civic leadership, he has focused on neighborhood association empowerment, economic and business development, housing revitalization and new housing developments, public safety initiatives, and programs that focus on giving positive alternatives to youth. After a career in the for-profit sector, working for Bank One and Xerox Corp, Glynn worked for Brightpoint, a nonprofit in Fort Wayne that helps people remove the causes and conditions of poverty. At Brightpoint, Glynn advocated for young people and taught high school juniors and seniors workforce readiness and college prep skills. Glynn joins us tonight to speak about his experiences as a Black student at Manchester during the racial tension of the 1960s and 70s, and his reflections on Afro Club and the formation of Afro House. It would be remiss of me if I did not take this opportunity to publicly thank you, Councilman, on behalf of all our students, but especially our diverse groups and diverse students. It is because of your efforts and the efforts of so many others that we can move confidently into actualizing our dreams of an even better Manchester and of an even better world. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming distinguished Manchester graduate, Councilman Glynn Hines.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And we send our prayers out to Dr. McFadden and his father, who had an accident, and that's the reason why he was not able to attend this evening. But our prayers are with you, Dr. McFadden, and your family. Well, good evening. And I am honored to have been asked to deliver the keynote address for this convocation session, commemorating the 53 years since the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King visited Manchester. And I was told that this is the actual podium that he used to speak when he came before you. So if I venture off a little bit and I start talking about the mountaintop and other things like that, please excuse me. But actually, I also want to thank the Afro Club, which is now the Black Student Union, who's still active on this campus, for continuing the legacy that we started back in the late 60s. Also, I want to thank the assembled. We have a few people who are actually in the audience, some students, esteemed student, and the press, who are going to ask some tough questions at the end. And you'll be able to also, through Facebook, contact us or Zoom. So we'll be looking forward to answering any questions you might have. Before we came here to the auditorium, we were in the Jean Young Multicultural Center, and it's beautiful, but I did want to mention that the Toyota Round, the reason why that is there partially is a good friend of mine, James Colin, we call him JC. What's up, JC? I'm sure he's watching. But he was able to get a major donation from the Toyota Corporation to make that facility happen. And we thank you, JC, for the leadership that you provided at Toyota, and you continue to provide even to this day out in Seattle, Washington, with your Toyota dealership. Plug. Also, I want to welcome back the students. I know some of you were able to go abroad during the January session, and some of you, of course, stayed local. But those of you that went abroad, I want to encourage you to make sure when you come back, you share with the other students your experiences, because Dr. Waz used to do that with us when he went to Africa. Every year, he would come back and share with us his experience. But those of you who went off abroad, I'd like for you to share with the other students what your experience was, particularly January the 6th, when the insurrection occurred, and what was the worldview of America and what they saw. But also, I especially want to welcome back the seniors, because I remember my senior year coming back after the January session. Of course, I stayed on campus, but after the January session started in February, it's all downhill. You can see the finish line. You got to do those things that you got to do to graduate. So I encourage you to finish strong. The last thing that I want to mention is that I want to give a thank you for the Board of Trustees for the work that they're doing with working with students. I believe, as was said when we were here, there was probably around 40 African-American students. And now I hear that 25% approximately of the population on this campus is people of color. And I think that's a very aggressive, a very progressive move. And I congratulate you for that. But you know, one of the reasons why I chose, and I was just asked that question a few minutes ago, why I chose to attend Manchester. And actually it was because in 1968, February the 1st to be exact, Dr. Martin Luther King visited Manchester, then college, and gave his speech. But the Fort Wayne newspaper picked that up because that was a big deal. Back in 1968, Dr. King was well known throughout the world. And for him to select Manchester, and that was the last college campus that he spoke on, as you well know, in April, he was assassinated. So in February the 1st, he was here in North Manchester. And that piqued my interest because I had never heard of Manchester College before that. And also, I think it was important that Dr. King chose to be here because Manchester had a legacy and still to this day has a legacy of recognizing the need for seeking alternatives to war and by offering peace as a major degree studies. And I think that's still to this day important and domestically, especially with what's going on today. It was extremely controversial for Dr. King in the late 60s to be here because believe it or not, I went back and did some research and his disapproval rating in 1968 before his murder was 76%, 76%. So he was not, as now today, everyone tried to say how great everyone loved him, but not back then. Many residents, as a matter of fact, here in Wabash County, hated the mission of civil and human rights and equal opportunity proposed by Dr. King. Dr. King had enraged many white racist war hawks when in 1967, he had speeches that questioned the role of America in the Vietnam conflict. The FBI and CIA were wiretapping and accusing Dr. King of being a communist sympathizer. Also, many of his own Black clergy thought that Dr. King had lost his resolve for the nonviolent peaceful resistance movement when he became outspoken regarding the military industrial complex and how the world viewed America, the dichotomy of fighting for freedom abroad, yet denying Black folks voting rights, civil rights, education, and employment opportunity right here in the great US of A. The same attitudes that reviled Colin Kaepernick when he took a knee to protest police killings of unarmed African-Americans are the same people who despise the Black Lives Matter movement last year was the same attitude that existed when Dr. King was faced with the 1950s and 60s, only worse because then the protesters were actually shot and some killed. The more things seemed to change, the more they seemed to remain the same. The 1960s was a very violent era, with much of it captured by the media. Can you imagine, however, if the cell phone technology that we have today was available back then, how we could have captured the vicious nature of the police brutality towards the civil rights protesters? But as my six-year-old grandson in Atlanta, Nikwe Cote, says, wait a minute, we did see the brutality of the March to Selma and the Edmund Pettus Bridge debacle. Thanks to the media of that era, we did catch the violence of the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1968 when Mayor Daley encouraged his police state style of governance, led to hundreds of protesters being tear gassed and hospitalized. And I personally vividly remember April the 4th, 1968, as many as you probably vividly remember September the 11th, 9/11, 2001, with the Twin Towers Terrorist Act, or of course, more recently, the insurrection that occurred January the 6th, right on Capitol Hill this year. Back in 1968, I was a junior at Central High School, which is located in downtown Fort Wayne, which is now in the Anthus Career Center. And I was on the varsity track team, and I was pretty good. I had ran track, my freshman year on through graduation, but I was running from my then girlfriend's house on LaSalle Street over to the 1319 East Wayne. It's about 17 blocks. And I used to run pretty good, but a car pulled up on the curb, blocked my way. The window came down and a guy said, "Hey, young blood, they killed the king. Whitey killed the king." Now I'm frightened to death. It's kind of late at night. So I took off sprinting and I ran home, went through the front door at 1319 East Wayne Street. And on the news, I believe it was Walter Cronkite. And he said, "In Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Motel today, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. The Prince of Peace has been murdered." And that stuck with me, obviously, but the Manchester leadership was clairvoyant, I believe, to have Dr. King on campus February the 1st, 1968, to share his thoughts, ideas, and vision and speech for a more perfect union with liberty and justice for all. So I say thank you again to the Board of Trustees then, and I heard it took about 9 years to convince Dr. King to actually come to the campus, but they were able to accomplish that feat and to do it in spite of the tension of the time. So Manchester, you have a legacy for providing rigorous academic environment for our students, but to also celebrate diversity and inclusion. And I thank you also for accepting hundreds of underprivileged young men and women like myself to attend and matriculate from Manchester. So today, I come to talk with you and share with you what I call hindsight, my personal perspective related to events that happened in my life that have helped to shape me to be the person of conscience that I am today. Many years ago, there was a pastor in Cleveland, Ohio named Reverend Dr. Otis Moss, and he once shared with the congregation, he stated that we all live a life and basically it boils down to our dash. That is to say that you are born, in Dr. King's example, January the 15th, 1929, and you will die, in his case, April the 4th, 1968. And the only thing on your grave marker is the date you were born, a dash, and the date that you die. And his challenge, Dr. Moss's challenge, was to everybody, how deep will your dash be? Will you contribute to the betterment of society like Dr. King, or will you contribute to the destruction of our American society like Donald Trump? The basic choices that you make on a daily basis is what determines what your legacy will be and how deep will your dash be. So please listen with an open mind and an open heart as I share with you hindsight of three phases of my American experience. Before I attended Manchester, the 4 years during Manchester, forming rightful objectives, and our condensed version of the approximately 50 years since I graduated from Manchester. I know I have a limited amount of time, but I will do my best to speak truth to power and not to lose your total interest. Dr. David Wise was the history department head when I attended Manchester, and he once said, and I quote, "Many times history is written from the perspective of the conqueror, not the conquered, or for the benefit of those who hold power to record the events with a slant that favors their values." With hindsight, I studied history, and I come to the conclusion that the conqueror steals, kills, and destroys, or tries to eradicate any semblance of any proof of major contributions from the conquered. An example, in Africa, General Rhodes took the cannons and lined them up and tried to blow off the faces of the Sphinx at pyramids in Giza. Adolf Hitler, millions of books, and murdered millions of Jews in most barbaric manner in gas chambers and subscribed to an Aryan white superiority race theory. European conquest throughout Africa and South America, and of course, North America. How can you come to America and discover the Iroquois, discover the Miami, discover the Cherokee nations? Even theologians profess that Jesus the Christ is a blonde-haired, blue-eyed visual makeup, even though the Bible itself described him as having skin like burnt bronze and hair like lamb's wool. Sounds like a brother to me. A must read is Dr. Chancellor Williams' book, The Destruction of the Black Civilization, where he highlights the academic and physical destruction of Africa's contributions to civilizations. The origins of humans in Olduvai Gorge, Tanzania, the great kingdoms of Mali and Songhai, Mansa Musa, the world's richest man of all times. And of course, America's original sin, white supremacy, white privilege, and that peculiar institution of slavery. As a history major here at Manchester, I was fortunate to have academic scholars like Dr. David Waz, Dr. Paul Keller, Dr. Bishop, Dr. Ken Brown, Dr. T.Q. Heavens, Dr. Fern Baldwin, and of course, Dr. Robert Johansson, who challenged us to use critical thinking skills to have academic inquiry into the why, not just the what. The world majority is 90% and always will be people of color. And the minority of white folks who have fought hard to inculcate all other cultures with their white superiority complex, mostly through violence. That's the elephant in the room that we need to address. Racism is a learned behavior perpetuated both individually and institutionally. We can never unite as a world society or as an American nation until we address that reality. So let me talk about before I came to Manchester and what was my world, what was going on in the 50s and the 60s. Civil rights movement was under attack. People did not want us to have liberty, justice for all, people of color. Many murders, 1963, the bombing at the Birmingham 16th Street Baptist Church of those four little girls. The Mississippi murders of civil rights activist Medgar Evers, the Freedom Riders, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, the Vietnam protest and the imperialism on full display, 1963 with the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the President of the United States. And I still say the Zapruder film shows the shot from behind and the shot from the front. So we know there was more than one shooter. 1965, the Audubon Ballroom. Malcolm X was murdered in front of his family. 1968, probably the bloodiest year that I can remember with civil rights movement. But of course, April 4th, the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. Later that same year, Robert Kennedy, the brother of President John Kennedy, was murdered in Los Angeles. The Chicago Democratic Convention and the violence that was shown there. And at least we never forget those Black students at South Carolina State in Orangeburg, South Carolina, that were murdered that year. Also, there were many riots in LA, in Watts, in Detroit, in the Black Bottom, in Chicago on the south and the west side of the city, in St. Louis. So during this time, there's all this violence occurring and all this tension. I had three staples in my life. The rudiments of my life were stabled by my family. I was fortunate enough to have both parents, Alfonso and Catherine Hines. My dad went to the eighth grade. My mom graduated from high school. I was the first Hines to ever graduate from college. But they instilled in us a work ethic. We had paper routes. We had responsibilities. But also academic achievement was focused in our house. My mom especially made sure we did our homework. You know, made sure that we focus on finishing high school and hopefully going to college. Also, there was the church. The church was a spiritual foundation that we had. And the late great Reverend Dr. Jesse White at the Progressive Baptist Church was not only a pastor, but he was a civil rights activist, an educational, economic development. And I'll never forget at 12 years old, we had to do our Easter recital. And mine was Philippians 4 and 13. For I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And that has stuck with me in my spirit ever since the age of 12. And then in the community, we had neighborhoods. Now they were segregated. So we were forced to live together, to do business with one another. And in my neighborhood, you could walk past a doctor's house, a lawyer's house, teachers lived down the street. And there was a community center. It was called the McCulloch Center. It's now called the Jennings Center. And it's named after Mr. Al Jennings, Hubba Hubba, because he was the one that instilled in us as young men how to treat the girls, how to act, you know, in public. And also Mr. Ed Elkins and Big John Archie. Those were the people that kind of formed us. So with all of that, when I got to high school and I decided I wanted to go to college, and I finished in the top 10% of my class, I had visited Indiana University because I was good in track and I could potentially have gotten a track scholarship there or Ball State. I visited there. Nobody liked the track coach. My last college visit was here to Manchester in November of 68, which was the beginning of my senior year. And Freddie Bullock, who was an All-America football player here at Manchester, was my first roommate. But he and I came on that college visit in November of 68. And I never forget that we had a convocation series. And one of the speakers was Sonia Sanchez, a poet laureate who was civil rights activist. The other was Dick Gregory, who was a comedian, but also a civil rights activist. But the most moving was Jesse Jackson Sr. He was actually here on campus the same year that Dr. King had been murdered in April the 4th. And if you remember the picture, when you Google Lorraine Hotel assassination, Dr. King, Jesse Jackson is the one pointing in the direction where the shot came from. And he explained to us, and there was not a dry eye in the auditorium when he told the story about how it was to have a friend and a mentor that close and to have to hear the shot and to run out on the balcony and see him there bleeding to death and to lose Dr. King in that fashion. But he still maintained that justice would be done and that we African-Americans would see the day of liberty and justice for all. So that did it for me. I decided right then and there that I wanted to come to Manchester. I was fortunate enough to get a Cummings scholarship and for my first 2 years to be able to afford to come here. But during the summer remediation session, I got my first exposure to white privilege on this campus. We had a couple of white students that took, and they made tar babies, and you could just take asphalt and roll it when it got hot, and they put it on our doorknob. And rather than kick butt, we decided to go to the administration and explain to them how offended we were by that act. And I would never forget the administration said, oh, it's just a college prank. That happened all the time here. I'm like, what? So we got together that night at Oakwood Hall at the time. I don't know if it's still there, but Oakwood Hall in the basement, we tore everything up in there we could. And they called us in and said, you don't do that. I said, well, the white kids did it to us. He said, no, you don't do it. You do it again, you'll be expelled. So that was our first exposure. But everyone knows about the historic event that occurred after the flag football game. There was a fight. And then that night at Schwamm Hall, there was a confrontation between the black students and the white students, the males at least, because that's where all the jocks back then lived in Schwamm Hall. It may still be the same way today. And I'll never forget Willie Stubbs, who was married to Sue Stubbs eventually, but not at the time. But Willie was on the basketball team, but he also was a Golden Gloves boxer. And when the guy who was calling all of us a bunch of N's said it, and Willie said, please don't say that. Just apologize and we can end it. We can squash this. And the guy said, I'm not apologizing to none of you, N-word. And Willie hit him with a left hook and all hell broke loose. But I was telling the story about Barney Fife. And what was so funny, Barney Fife, if you think about the physical Barney Fife on Andy Griffin, this guy looked just like him. And he came and sprayed all the brothers that he could spray with the mace. And it was funny how there was like 20 of us and 200 of the white kids, but Barney Fife chose to spray us, and I never forget him. But anyway, out of that melee, I remember Myron Chenault, who was a senior and kind of the leader of the black students for that period, had advised for us to go to Petersheim and hold up in there, which we did. Well, out of that came national, back then they only had three channels, NBC, ABC, and CBS. But all three channels covered the fact that there was a riot at Manchester College and that the Black students had held up in the Peter Sine Chapel, and we didn't know what was going to happen. I was listening to AOC the other day talk about when the insurrection occurred and how she hid in her office and the terror she felt not knowing. And for us in Peter Sine, not knowing what was going to happen to us at that time was deathly fearful of what might happen to us. But of course, thank God, nothing happened physically to us. And we were able to, out of that, negotiate with the administration so that we could have a club. And let me digress a little bit. While I was here for the summer session, I was thinking about, since I had visited IU and Ball State, about starting a Black student union type organization here, which you now have a Black student union. But at the time, they didn't have any such thing. So I came up with the idea of naming it the Afro Club, Afro-Americans Forming Rightful Objectives. Because in that day, colored was not used that much. Negro was kind of acceptable, but better would have been either calling us Black or Afro-Americans or African-Americans. So we chose Afro Club. And then out of that, the discussion with the administration, we wanted the club to be formalized. We wanted a African-American advisor, because we had none, someone who could come on campus and talk to us about our issues. And we wanted a place to go where we could, you know, listen to our music talk. Because in the dorm, anytime the Black student played their music at a certain decibel, you know, the RA, the resident assistant, would come and tell you to turn that mess down or off or whatever. And it caused friction. So thank God the administration adhered to all three of those. The Afro Club was formed. The Afro House was secured, and we had a guy named J. Webb Horton who came in the last few years. We had Bill Tavis out of Fort Wayne, who was a Southside High School, Ball State graduate with the Fort Wayne Community Schools, and he would come and advise us. But the Afro Club, Afro House became the center of our universe as it relates to the African-American students, because we could meet there and have engaging conversations. And the beauty of it, and this is going back to those professors on campus, Dr. Waz would come over to the Afro House and share with us. Ken Brown actually had in his home, and I believe to this day, he would have us come over to his home and have discussions, or he would come to the Afro House. So we had professors that was trying to help us understand how we can navigate our way through this four-year institution of higher learning. And it was great that that happened and the positive experience, but real quick, overall, for the 4 years that we were here, it was very challenging as an African-American student. Like I said, that first year, there had been, before I came, about 14 African-American students on campus. In that year alone, 26, 27 of us came on the campus. So there was over 40 on a campus of about 1,400 then. Of course, now the number's a lot bigger, close to 200, over 200, if you can count all the students of color. But for that period of time, it was extremely challenging for us to even go to the cafeteria without them asking to see our IDs, and they wouldn't ask the white kids. Going to the library, and if you spoke above a certain decibel, you had to leave the library, couldn't stay, congregate out in front of the student union, and then here comes Barney Fife and the security making us move. But one of the worst things that happened was whenever we had intramural basketball games, it was like the whole gym was cheering against us. And of course, the referees were cheating. But we always had a challenge no matter what we tried to do. And for me, you know, I made it through 3.5 years until my senior year in December. I'll never forget when Barney came to the door of my last final and said, "You got to go down and see Dr. Hoffman. They need to see you." I said, "Well, I'm going to go back to my room first." "No, you know." He escorted me down to the office and they read a list, and it's probably in my file, so you can read it too, public information access. But they had everything that had happened from the summer session of 69 at Oakwood Hall, all the way through the flag football and the Schwamm Hall and Peter Sine, and every time we had encountered a student. I didn't have any problems, believe it or not, with any of the professors. It was just the students and old Barney Fife that we had problems with. But I was expelled. Luckily, there was an appeals And I was allowed to come back to campus for the January session, but I was required to live off campus, and I could only come on campus to go to class, to go to the library, or to work at a part-time job in the student union. And I lived, I mean, literally, I lived in the library. Greatest thing ever happened to me. Of course, my GPA, my senior year, had shot up to about a 3.5, and I graduated, and I got accepted into Temple. But the last thing that I did of any significance, and I still want the yearbook of 1970, I'm gonna try to get that, because I the May Day activities was big here on campus, probably still is. But I had read The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, and he was an abolitionist, he had been a slave, became an abolitionist, and it excited me because he was so moving in his story. And then I was obviously a double major in speech and drama. So I asked the drama professor if I could use The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass and make it into a play for the May Day play. And he said, sure, great idea, which we did. But needless to say, the play was not liked by everybody, because in the play, one of the things that Frederick Douglass had said that had stuck with me and it came out in the play was, and it's in his book, and it's the relationship between progress and struggle. And Frederick said, and I quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be moral, or it may be physical, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." And that has been kind of my mantra in all the things that I have done since graduating from Manchester. It's been heavily involved in trying to help particularly young people, but also through my activities of various organizations that I've been a part of. I was fortunate enough, as I said, that some of the professors scraped together enough money for me to go to Philadelphia to apply for Temple, because it was a special program. And I applied, and I was accepted at Temple University grad school. And I taught in the Wissahickon School District. And while I was there, I immersed myself within the Ambler Black community that existed out there. But also we helped develop a Black studies curriculum so that the kids, because they were so isolated, that they didn't have a lot of exposure in the suburbs to Black studies, and we were able to improve upon that. And then I moved back to Fort Wayne. As it was said earlier, I worked with corporate America, with Xerox and Bank One, which is now Chase. And I was also, besides being a corporate cash manager at the bank, I did diversity training, which was excellent to be the trainer, because the banks at the time, and still to this day, probably practice redlining and discriminatory practices. So I had to make sure that I was able to work with them on that. And that was one of the things we did. And then, of course, as was said, I ran for office in 1999 and I won. And I was in 6th district for 5 terms. And then in 2019, I decided to run at large, because no African-American had ever, in the history of the city of Fort Wayne, on the common council, had African-American had served. So I did succession planning with Sharon Tucker to make sure that she would take my place, because there had never been an African-American female. And part of my dash, my legacy, I wanted to make sure that I did all I could to advance women's opportunities in business and, of course, in government. So I worked with her on that. And then, of course, in 2019, there's 3 at-large positions on city council, and never before had an African-American been in that position. So I ended up getting the 2nd most votes, and Michelle Chambers got the 3rd. So we had 2 African-Americans at large. We have that today. And Sharon, so there's never before had been 3 African-Americans to serve on the Fort Wayne Common Council, which was a major accomplishment. And then also one of the things that I had did during the course of being on city council, I had worked with an organization called Stop the Madness. It's a youth mentoring organization. And what we did is we took mostly kids that needed a mentor in their life, and we tried to match up the young boys with an adult, the young girls with an adult female, adult male, and to make sure that they had someone to help them. Well, I ended up being a mentor to a young man by the name of DeAntoine Johnson, and he's probably watching. What's up, DJ? But I ended up mentoring him because he was the oldest of 13 kids. He was the oldest of 13, and they all were in different foster homes. And DeAntoine had ups and downs in his life, but I remember him taking control of his life, saying that, you know, Mr. Hines, I wanna go to California and live with my aunt so that when I graduate from high school, I can then go to college for free. And I don't have the money for a bus. I said, well, I'm not giving you the money for a bus. He said, what? I said, I'm not giving you money for a bus. I'm gonna get you a plane ticket. You're gonna fly to California. He said, wow, Mr. Hines, I've never flown before. And he'll tell you the story if you ever have him come to Manchester to speak. But he said that when he got on the plane, he was scared to death. And he said, and it was a cloudy day, but when he got above the clouds, he said he could see the sun. So the title of his book is The Sun is Always Shining. And it's a metaphor for his life, because his life was a cloud until he took control of his life and decided that he wanted to do some things and he needed to do some things. And he planned out to go to California, which was the sun in his life. And I'm proud to say today that he went to California, graduated from high school, got an associate degree, got a bachelor's degree, and he just completed his second master's degree. And DeAntoine is a speaker. He has a book out, of course, called The Sun is Always Shining. Go to Amazon, order a bunch of the books, give them to your friends, because it's a very moving story of a young man in a foster program. You talk about studying poverty. You know, you need to study his story of what occurred to him, but he's come out of it. So that's, again, in my dash, I always look at opportunities to reach back and to help some man or some woman. So I know I need to wrap up because we want to get some of the online viewers, but I just want to conclude in talking about those years that Dr. King's dream, we can see sparkles of hope with Barack Obama being elected president. I said that I never thought I would see the day that a Black man would be president of the United States. And of course, when Dr. King talked about his vision and about what he wanted and why he fought to get Voting Rights Act enacted, that's one of the reasons so that we could achieve that. The students here at Manchester University with your Black Student Union and the multicultural, you know, hopefully you guys are using the Gene Young Center in order to have those discussions, those Black Lives Matter discussions, talking about George Floyd, say his name, and the things that occurred. And I know with COVID, it's so hard to gather, but you can obviously do what you do as you do Zoom meetings and meetings of that discussion. We need to, that is us, need to take the lead on having those discussions. Kamala Harris, the first African-American, the first woman for that matter, vice president. So Dr. King's dream is being realized. And we need to have all of us a part of the answer. We need to take a minute in order to invest in ourselves, in another person, to say that here's what we can do. And one of the things that Dr. Benjamin Nays, the president at one time of Morehouse College, had a statement that he would make to all the students, and it was only a minute. And here's what he said. I have only a minute, only 60 seconds in it. Forced upon me, can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it, but it's up to me to use it. I must suffer if I lose it, give account if I abuse it. Just a tiny minute, but there's an eternity in it. So I'm gonna challenge you, young man, young woman, sir, to take a minute and get to know your neighbor. Get involved in your community. Spend some time to stop the lie. 306 electoral votes, 81 million popular votes. There was no proof of fraud. You have to stop the lie. You have to stop anybody who says that Biden Harris did not legitimately win. You've got to stop this madness. And anyone that's saying that to this day is psychotic, and you have to refer them for mental assistance. Manchester, as an institution, you have been a world leader with peace studies. You need to offer an anti-course that is required for everybody to take, maybe in the January session, those of you that don't go abroad. But please, ma'am, please, sir, do all that you can. Life is so short, but it only takes a minute, only 60 seconds, but there's an eternity in it. Thank you. Now I think we're going to get into the questions.
Hello. My question is, what do you think is the most important thing for us as current Manchester University students to do to continue our school's progress towards anti-racism?
And if I heard you, is what do I think is most important for you to do regarding what?
As current Manchester University students, to continue our school's progress towards anti-racism.
Well, yeah, I mentioned some of the things. Just, you know, one of the things I find, you know, and I was going through my yearbook, and I went through and I looked at all the pictures of people that were in my senior year, and I didn't know that many. I went to this campus for 4 years, and I had people that I graduated with. I remember magna cum laude or summa cum laude individual. I had never seen him on the campus before. We need to talk to each other. We need to have those open, frank discussions about how we feel. And I'm just going to use the January 6th insurrection. We need to talk about, because that was pure and simple, an insurrection. It was a bunch of people that were angry because of misinformation, and to the extent that Donald Trump should be found guilty, it's clear. I mean, all the evidence is there, but we as young people, or you as young people, I'm not young, young in spirit, but you got to talk to each other. So tonight, tomorrow, whether it be on campus or in your dorm, or in your home for that matter, is to have those conversations. And I made a list of things because I thought somebody might ask that kind of a question. So what can I do? And I put volunteer in your community, donate your time and talent, educate yourself through the internet. If you go to Google and you Google anti-racism, there is actually curriculum already developed that you can read about anti-racism. And then I hear people talk about racial tolerance. I'm not talking about tolerance. I'm talking about celebration, celebrating the difference that we all have. Read a book. And there's a whole list of books. If you put racial injustice or racial justice, anti-racism, there's a book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Me and White Supremacy by Layla Saad. And then Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. And if you Google anti-racism, all those books are listed. So you can find easily information. But as Joe Madison on Urban Talk Radio says, what are you going to do? And I think the challenge is we have to take it and make it a personal. I want to be a better person. What can I do? And sometimes it's just a matter of improved communications.
Thank you. Another question we had was, what difficulties did you face when forming the Afro Club and the house?
Well, the number one difficulty at the time, you got to understand, 1970 was acceptance by the administration that there was a need, because a lot of times people say, well, hey, why don't you just mix in, mingle with the students that you have? But that's easier said than done, because back then, like I was saying about even today, I don't know how many students of color, if you're not of color, that you engage with. Oftentimes, and I looked at the stats, back then it was about 70 to 80%. Now I looked at the website for Manchester, and about 76% of the students are from Indiana. So that means they got a red state mentality for the most part. Conservative, small town, that kind of stuff. So you got to reach out and communicate with other people. So the administration thought that all we had to do was just reach out, but that wasn't that case. We did have, and I remember one white student, we call him the Georgia Peach, but he always hung out at the Afro House because he came to us to try to better understand. So the Afro House was a challenge, the Afro Club, not quite. I think it was a shame that the Peter Syme incident is what brought it to full head, but I'm real proud. And I took my wife around and I showed her where the Afro House used to be on Miami, and then right across the street, it used to be there, and then next door to the Gene, and now the Multicultural Center is unbelievable compared to those facilities in terms of what you can do in there. I saw the library, the computer lab. We had none of that. So it's advanced greatly. So yeah, it was a challenge at the time, remembering the atmosphere of the 70s.
So I had a question that is kind of similar to Libby's, but I was wondering if you could talk about what the dynamic was like between Afro Club and the other student organizations on campus, if there was any tension, and also if you sought out support from any other student organizations and what that was like.
Well, the other student organizations was made up of other students, and the other students, and besides in the classroom, there was very little interaction. If you were on the football team, you interacted. If you were on the basketball team, you interacted. But for the most part, like I said, out of my senior class, I hardly knew any of those students because we didn't have classes together. And basically, while you're on campus, a lot of students, particularly I would say from these smaller towns, you're told to go to school, get your degree, find a husband if you're a woman. I'm just kidding. But truly, some people were told that. But there was not a lot of interaction between the organizations, you know, that you would think. I mean, there was a student government. And I think at one time, Myron Chenault might have been on that. But that was my freshman year. And Myron, I think he ended up being a lawyer. But he was always political and outward going. And I think, but he was probably one of the few African-Americans that was involved with student government. But for the most part, no. There was not a lot of support, not a lot of interaction between organizations, and very little communications. Very little.
All right, I've got a few questions from our online viewers here. One from Carlos on Facebook, who is wondering how the church and other faith communities can help in anti-racism work.
Well, thanks, Carlos. If that's Carlos, my son-in-law, I'm glad he is watching, but as you well know, Manchester is a Church of the Brethren based institution. And one of the things that in any community, the church can do is be the beacon of hope and understanding. Because I think if you use as your center point, those of us who are Christian, you know, what was the mission, vision, and purpose of Jesus the Christ? What is it that he wanted to do? And the most important thing is he wanted us to love. He taught love. And if we can start at that point and understand that I can love my brother and sister as I love myself and share, then that's one thing. So we've got to have that spiritual base. Like I use Philippians 4 and 13 to give me my motivation, inspiration as it relates to my foundation. But I think the church in the civil rights movement at one time actually led it. And in some cases, in some communities, I think like in Georgia, obviously the senator, the pastor of his church ran and won. But I think in many communities, the church is not, particularly the African-American church, is not politically as involved as it was during the 60s, for example. And then also remember, Carlos, as you well know, that Dr. King in 1968 was not that popular with all of the Black clergy, because he kind of went to talk about Vietnam and how we need to, you know, get out of that war. And he started talking about economic rights. He talked about that blank check that was never filled out. I mean, there's some things that Dr. King, when he and Malcolm start getting together, that was swaying it kind of away from that Christian turn the other cheek thing to, you know, we might need to do some other kinds of activism in order to accomplish. So the church has a vital role to play. And when people say, at least what I've heard, is only 20% of the public actually attends church or is, you know, in the church, that means we got an 80% opportunity to save souls. So Carlos and all the other ministers, you know, get busy. You know, oftentimes, I know now with COVID, we got to do stuff online, but when COVID is over, let's get to the streets. Let's go to where the people are and find out why they're not in the church and what we can do to get them more involved so that they can get centered on love. And if you get them centered on love, then they're not able to be a white racist, a white supremacist, or a Black racist for that matter.
Thank you so much, Councilman Hines. Can you share what you think about students, especially students of color, who are struggling right now, feeling tired or not engaged as much as, you know, we would expect them or would want them to be? If there's something that you could share with them, that'd be appreciated.
Well, one of the things right now, and I think this is accurate to say that everybody is COVID fatigued. Everybody is COVID fatigued. Now, on top of that, if you're a Black student and Black Lives Matter, you're every day, particularly if you're in urban areas, you're scared for your life. When your car gets stopped, you don't know if you're going to live or die. It's that bad. And with the system now protecting the police, when they do kill or injure or maim an individual, young Black folks, y'all have a reason, you know, to be tired. But I'm going to tell you, we got to band together. That is, don't be an island. You know, find somebody, a friend, an associate that you can, like in college, if I'm not good with math, find somebody who's good with math. You know, if I'm not good with writing papers, find somebody that's good and get some help. Don't try to just do it all by yourself. And of course, with this being a Church of the Brethren Christian institution, you got to get into prayer. I mean, one of the things that we don't do enough of is thank the Lord and Savior for our many blessings and call on him, not when we're in trouble, but when things are fine. But mainly, I'm on a tip now. I'm finding and watching the most grateful thing I saw in Black Lives Matter was white kids all over the world got it. And that's what happened kind of back in the civil rights day. They got it. So the Black students, you know, need to, number one, understand better what their strengths and weaknesses are and hone in on the strengths and work on the weaknesses. They need to communicate with each other and outside of the group so that they can get help where they need help. And one of the things I know as a Black man, we hate to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but mental health issues, and I think the suicide rates are up, is real. And I think that we need to seek counseling in the case where we're really thinking about doing some harm to ourselves in order to not do that and to seek professional counseling in some cases. I think all of those things are piece and parcel of the solution set. Thank you, sister.
Thanks. Our next question comes from one of our esteemed English professors, Beata Gilliar, and she's wondering if you think that you were able to educate or transform the consciousness of any fellow students who practiced racism.
Say that again.
Do you think that you were able to educate or transform the consciousness of any fellow students who practiced racism?
Well, do I think that I was able to, either through this speech or in my daily work? Okay. Through my daily work, I would say absolutely yes, because I have more time. The speech, what I wanted to do of consciousness, I think the one thing in America that we've never had a good conversation about is white supremacy, white racism, white privilege. We skirt around that issue. And I think that we've got to have an honest conversation about what's happening in America. And there are some people that the conspiracy theorists, you know, whatever those folks who ran up the steps at Capitol that believe it, the race, the campaign, the election was a fraud. If they were listening to me, they would be mad at me because they don't want to hear anything about Donald Trump not winning the election. So I come to the realization that there are some people who are rational, who you can talk to and you can have a good conversation with, and they'll listen to some of what you say. But some people, as soon as I started talking about white racism and white supremacy, they turned Facebook and they didn't listen to anything else I said because they don't want to hear the truth. They don't want to hear the reality of what it is in America. And America's major issue is that they don't want to address the fact, and that whether it's the peace program or the poverty studies or whatever you have to try to educate people, until you change the hearts and minds of people to understand the realities of the other folk, you know, you cannot reach them. So no, I don't try to reach everybody. I try to reach people with an open heart and an open mind that want to get a better understanding. But if they're stuck on stupid, that's not a me problem, that's a you problem. And they're going to be like that probably until something happened to them. I'm going to give you one last example, and that is with COVID. So I'm on city council. And if you ever tune in to cable access, you'll see that the Democrats wear masks in council. And if you look and see, the Republicans don't wear masks. Now, that's not political, but one of the Republicans got COVID and now they wear a mask. And I see the reality of it is, until it happens to them, you know, I don't want to do that. Until, you know, something happens to them that occurs in their life to change their heart, there's very little that we can say as individuals of belief to change their heart. So it's up to them to want to receive information and to at least challenge themselves to think differently.
We've got another question here from the Zoom chat, wondering what sustained your decision to stay on as a student at Manchester despite acts of discrimination?
Two things. One was, mostly was, my mother and father had said to me, had said to my oldest brother, Alvin, and then my brother, Michael, and then me, was that you're going to do better than I did. And it wasn't a question mark. It was an explanation point. You're going to do better. You're going to go beyond the eighth grade. You're going to go beyond college. So when I came to college, as smart as I was, finishing the top 10% of my class, finding out that college wasn't really that a challenge. You had to get your butt up out of bed. You had to go to class. You had to do your assignments, not the night before or the last minute. You had to do them ahead of time so you didn't have stress. So what kept me going was I wanted that degree from Manchester College at the time, university. Now, I wanted that degree more than I wanted anything else. So I did everything I could to graduate on time and a double major. I went back through the yearbook and I looked to see how many seniors had double majors in my class. Very few, very few. So I was focused enough to have a double major, want to graduate, and all that other stuff. That was, like I said before, that was their problem. Those little white racist, little privileged, snotty-nosed other students that tried to mess with me, they couldn't penetrate me because I had, you know, thick skin, you know, and I would fight and I'd get in trouble for doing that, but I wasn't going to let them stop me until, of course, December 1972, when they kicked my butt out of here. And I was like, oh, Lord, here we go. So I had to put the bag on at the hearing to say, hey, look, this is a Christian institution. How dare you kick me out? And look at my GPA. Look what I'm doing academically. You're trying to kick me out because I don't get along with these little snotty-nosed, white privileged students who don't want me here. I said, that's on you. And then I talked about forgiveness. I said, I've done all these things. Yeah, a lot of them. But what about the Christian, Judeo-Christian ethic of forgiveness? I got one semester to go to graduate. You want to kick me out? How dare you? And of course, they changed their mind and decided to let me come back from a senior year, and the rest is history. But yeah, I was determined to graduate. Yes.
Councilman, you were part of an intentionally recruited group to come to Manchester. And the administration recruited you in part because of what they felt was a charge from Martin Luther King when he was here to really make Manchester a place that was welcome to Black students and would include Black students in our community. And I wonder what charge you would give Manchester today.
Oh, good question. Like that. Like I was saying earlier, I still think there's room for improvement. I think I met one professor in the arts program one. I don't know if there's five or there's 10 that I didn't see, but I met one. And one of the things that we had talked about back in 1969-70 was having tenured professors on campus that looked like us. In my 4 years, I think we might've had one in the English department, maybe one. That was one thing. The other thing, I'm serious when I said that if you can have peace studies, if you can have poverty studies, you should have anti-racism as a course specifically for this campus, because like I said, about 70%+ of you students are from Indiana, the red state politically and the redneck state emotionally when it comes to dealing with folks of color. So you don't have a real appreciation. You might tolerate, and that word just absolutely turns me off, as opposed to celebrating the differences that we have. So I think Manchester could do that. I think you could have a better connection with the city of Fort Wayne. because I know I was telling a story about people who go off into foreign countries to try to do good, to help impoverished people of Africa, South America. And you can go down on Lewis and Hannah Street and find a whole bunch of folks that would fit that framework that you're looking to help. There's a lot of Black churches right there in Fort Wayne, social service agencies right there in Fort Wayne that you can interact with. I think there needs to be a better connection. 35 minutes away, 35 miles away is close enough that we could have better relationships. And I can share with you a number of organizations that are doing the work because we have a major problem with the food deserts, food insecurity. And I just call it being poor because you can't afford to buy and you don't have access. You know, in the 46806, 4616 area, it's about 46,000 people that live in that area. And you've got a couple of grocery stores, a whole lot of gas stations that sell junk. But the main thing of it is we need to have those kind of resources that everyone else has access to. And Manchester can play a role in that. Two things you do. You're educating folks with degrees in these areas, and Fort Wayne is a nice place to work. And then some people, I know you said some professors live in Fort Wayne, they come here. Well, you can live here and work in Fort Wayne as well. So that would be my suggestion. We good? Is it a wrap? Thank you for having me.
Councilman, thank you so much again for your impassioned words, your profound words, and your vision for Manchester University. And thank you all for showing up tonight. Thank you for being here, for being present, and asking your very thoughtful questions. Have a good evening.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Anne Gregory for providing the audio for this program. Our music is by Mark Waldick, Noah Campodonico, and Kurt Remke. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship, Steve Mullaney, and Sydney Wagner. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI, Fort Wayne.